are listening to People Rise Up on KBOO here in Portland, Oregon, USA. Welcome to the bonus week of our spring membership drive. Things were a little slow, apparently, in other programs during the past 3 weeks, so we've got a couple extra days here for you. And today, to round out my spring membership drive programming, I'm very happy to have with me the author of This Land Is Their Land, How Corporate Farms Threaten the World. His name is Evagelos Valianatos, and he spent more than 2 decades working in the pesticide program at the Environmental Protection Agency. He's written several books about rural and farm issues, and he grew up on a family farm in Greece. Welcome to our airwaves, Evagelos.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Very, very glad to have you with us. Now, let's talk just a little bit about your personal background and the manner in which you are experienced to write about farm issues kind of around the world. This book really does not just touch on the United States. So why don't we start at the beginning? You grew up on a family farm in Greece. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what you learned from watching your father farm to feed his family?
Okay. I grew up on an island known as Kefalonia. It's in the western Greek islands between Greece and Italy. And my father had about, at the maximum, 9 acres of land, but divided into strips of land. And most of this land was covered by olive trees, so we could produce olive oil. And we also had vines for wine and a small flock of goats and small flock of sheep. And my father also cultivated land for wheat and lentils. So we were self-reliant in food. The idea with this sort of farming is that we never went hungry despite the war and despite civil war and despite all the adversities that the country faced in the 40s and 50s. And observing my father doing what he did, I got the idea, and also by reading Greek history, that this way of raising food was far more than just producing food. It was a way of life, in a sense. You respected nature. You had to work with nature to do what you expected to get out of the land. And you became a better citizen as a result of that. These are the ideas I brought with me when I got to the United States at the age of 18. And I started studying at the University of Illinois and then Wisconsin, where I got my doctorate in Greek history, of all things.
Right, which doesn't necessarily seem like it relates to the issue of farming, but you did get a B.A. in zoology.
Yeah, B.A. In zoology and doctor's degree in history, but at that time I did my postdoctoral at Harvard, and there I began to change from history to environmental and agricultural issues. And as part of getting a grant, I managed to go to Colombia, and I did a case study of the so-called Green Revolution, that is the passion of the industrialized agriculture from the United States to places like Colombia and India. And during that visit in Colombia, I really was convinced that the whole idea of industrialized agriculture, well, there was something definitely wrong with it. Because in industrialized something that used to be a way of life, you destroy that way of life. And you created something that was absolutely technical and sometimes fake and sometimes deleterious, not only to nature but also to the people that were to use it to produce what they needed to survive. And this was 1975-76. My first book was published in 1976, and I looked at the whole industrialized agriculture, but from the point of view of how do you transfer one idea from here to there. And with that book, I came to Washington, D.C., where I found my first job, my first position with the U.S. Office of Technology Assessment, that used to be a kind of a joint committee in Congress that sought advice from this technical group of people about a number of technology issues, including that of agriculture. And during that experience, I was almost convinced even more that there was something very wrong with the industrialized agriculture, because despite my urgent requests for doing something about the family farming in the United States, I was always rebuffed, and we had to do whatever we had to do in order to assist corporations, that is large corporations, to exploit the land even more ruthlessly and more technically, so to speak.
Now, tell us a little bit about what it was that you did in the U.S. EPA pesticide program. And
okay, we get to several years later, in 1979, I started at the U.S. EPA, and of course I had written already that first book, and I knew a little bit about agriculture. But I happened to end up in this program that deals with the so-called regulation of pesticides. And I spent 25 years, most of the 25 years were with that program. And I was an analyst, so I was a generalist, so that I dealt with all sorts of issues from farm worker protection to the actual data that chemical companies have to give to the government in order to approve certain of their chemicals, pesticides. And in general, you might say that, you know, the EPA is a huge organization. In my opinion, it's about 70,000 people. You find in 70,000 people, you have good people and not so good people. But the point about the pesticides is that this is a government organization that, in a sense, is promoting, supporting, and making viable things that should never even have been brought into existence, that is, deleterious substances, many of which rate their history from World War II chemical warfare. This is the deleterious, this is the bad things about the government, is that they're supporting a program that should not exist, because farmers have for millennia raised food like my father without a drop of these chemicals. Now, because of the political dimensions of all this, you have companies from all over the world, not just the United States, that they come and they provide technical data to EPA to approve certain chemicals, and then of course the chemicals get approved and then they're sold to all over the world, including the farmers of the United States.
Now I was going to ask, for people who don't know the history of the transfer of information about chemicals from warfare, World War I and World War II, to commercial agriculture, I was wondering if you could explain that just kind of simply for folks who don't know it.
In World War II, the Allies and the Germans with the Italians, they were both creating chemical warfare agents to throw at each other. But because they had the dreadful experience of World War I, they did not use chemical warfare against each other in World War II. But World War II came to an end, so the Allies, for instance, DDT, it was part of this experiment. They discovered that DDT is not lethal to humans, but it also can kill insects. So they passed DDT and all sorts of other chemicals that had been prepared during World War II to farmers to kill insects, to kill weeds. And because of this, this is the 1950s, when we're talking about late 40s and early 50s, the United States was the superpower during that time. So they felt this was part of science, that is, to develop these lethal weapons and bring them to the facility of the farmer, so that the farmer did not have to use any labor, so they could use these chemicals to kill insects and weeds in tremendous expanses of the land. And that's how the things moved in. And then they convinced the land-grant universities to put their imprimatur, so to speak, to say, this is science, this is advanced biology, advanced chemistry. And to me, that is another dreadful mistake that the scientists of this country have done, that is to join the military and to join the big agriculture in order to convince the farmers that this is, in fact, for their own benefit. Well, it's not to their benefit, because they poison our own food, they poison our drinking water. And they kill countless number of birds and wildlife all over the country. And I noticed that in my own personal experience with EPA. We were getting together with toxicologists, people experts in toxics, and ecologists, experts in wildlife, and we would decide about a chemical. And I would hear the toxicologist say, this is the cup of risk is almost overflowing, meaning that the stuff we eat might not be as safe as we think it is. And then ecologists would say, well, we're killing all these wild species, and we're pushing a dangerous species to extinction. So I would raise my hand and say, gentlemen, ladies, why don't we write a letter to the director of the program saying that we don't think that this chemical should remain in the market? And most of the times, of course, they ignore me. And this is because they were worrying about their own careers. I mean, if you're a bureaucrat, you have to be a yes man or a yes woman to be promoted to go on with your ambitions. So
right,
you begin
you don't want to remove what it is you're supposed to regulate. You take your purpose in the job away.
Exactly. If you raise questions like I did, then you are overlooked. You never get promoted. You be given busy work. I mean, your career is over pretty much. And this is exactly what happened to my career. But I could not. I had to face either being real, that is to be honest and ethical, or to be careerist, to get promoted from just 12, 13, 14 and make 100,000 and more and more and more. So I took the the difficult way out, but that's fine. I feel good about myself because of this.
You are listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My guest this morning is Evagelos Valianatos. He is the author of This Land Is Their Land, How Corporate Farms Threaten the World. And he spent about 25 years or so in the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency pesticide program. He's written other books about the state of farming, both here in the U.S. and talking about rural areas around the world. And I'm glad to welcome you back, Evagelos.
Thank you very much.
Now, we're obviously not going to be able to talk about everything here in the book, but I do want to touch on at least some of your international travels you describe in the book in looking at farms. You referenced briefly that you'd been to Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's more that you want to elaborate upon on that trip, or if you have a specific place that you would like to talk about. The book opens with your discussion of being in Brazil about, I guess, 12 or 13 years ago. I don't know if that's something you'd like to talk about or a different area.
Okay, well, the key lesson I took out of being in Colombia was that the scientists in one of the international agricultural research institutes that were developing the so-called Green Revolution, they were lying to me when they were telling me that they were helping peasants or small farmers. What, in a sense, they were doing, they were helping the large farmers to become even larger and control even more of the land. In the case of Brazil, in 1991, 1992, we were talking about the whole idea of sustainable development and climate change. And what happened there was I was supposed to address the question of sustainable development. And because they read my paper was very critical of the international system, they did not allow me to talk about that, but they put me in a small group of people. And despite that, however, the whole idea of agrarian reform, which was the subject of my paper, was the most popular idea, because the Brazilian scientists agreed with me, and they said there is no greater need, not just in Brazil, but in most of the world, for agrarian reform, meaning that we need to take land out of people who have too much and give it to people who have none. And this is very much true even for the United States. If we're going to develop something better than what we have, we need to give to the young people and other people who want to go into agriculture, we need to give them a small amount of land so they can do agriculture the correct way. They have to do agriculture the way their grandfathers used to do it, without the use of these toxic chemicals and without destroying the land. That is the whole idea, and I discovered the same thing in Africa when I was in Africa. Africa is less rich, very powerful, very, very rich in terms of biodiversity, and yet the people are starving. And they're starving because the Westerners, particularly the Europeans, when they went to Africa, they taught the Africans to eat European food rather than African food. And all the wonderful seeds and trees and roots that used to provide food for Africans were being set aside. Indeed, in 1996, the Academy of Science, the U.S. Academy of Science, published a wonderful book, The Lost Crops of Africa. And they said, Africa still has 2,000 different varieties of food that they can actually use, but they don't use it, as I said, because these are in the periphery of the continent, and they have put all their energies into cash crops in order to feed the Europeans and the Americans so that we can develop our chocolates and we can develop our teas and all these luxury crops, and the Africans are starving. To me, it's evil. I mean, you have children in Africa that are being kidnapped to grow, to go and work for the chocolate, for the cacao plantations in Ivory Coast, for instance. Now, so when we eat chocolate, we ought to think of those African children that they actually almost work like slaves. And this is at the heart of the international food system. That is, agriculture, agribusiness has taken over most of what it used to be family farming in the United States, and what it was peasant agriculture in Africa and Asia, and they have put everybody else to work for them. And in one way or another, we have almost less moving into back into the Dark Ages where you have feudalism.
Right, and the reason that Africans are growing cash crops is basically they were pulled or forced into the global monetary economy after the era of colonialization, and in needing money to develop the way they were told they needed to develop, they needed a means to pull in foreign currency, dollars. And the way they were able to do that was to exploit the land and export to Western markets, coffee, sugars, cocoa, other tropical fruits. And as you say, you know, not grow food for themselves. And the entire debt burden via the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, mm-hmm. I imagine the U.S. Agency for International Development.
Exactly. You're right.
You know, a lot of these countries that have borrowed tens and hundreds of billions of dollars collectively, a lot of that debt has actually been paid off. But the way the interest system works, they have paid off what amounts to the initial principal of the loans, but still have a whole lot of debt, and this is why they kind of can't break free of this cycle.
Well, then, not only that, but you have corrupt political leaders like in Nigeria before this man who's running the country, that these are known as kleptocrats. That is, they steal the money, which comes through the IMF or the World Bank, and then they reinvest it in the U.S. or Switzerland. So you have corrupt kleptocratic regimes, plus you have this ugly tradition tried to feed already well-fed people in Europe and North America with their own crops, and in the process they abandon their own food. So it's a tremendous challenge and a tragedy on a global scale, it seems to me. And this is a result of this giant industrial agriculture that has taken science as a daughter, and science has been corrupted to give it a legitimacy, so that we have 65 Langrand universities working entirely for agribusiness. They have abandoned their own mission, which was to support family farmer, make it in the United States. Instead now, they're putting all their efforts into genetic engineering and into big machinery and into pesticides, things that are not really in the mission of the creation of these universities. And it seems to me that's a shame, because that destroys democracy, that destroys science, and it just leaves a legacy of terror for our own grandchildren and children.
Well, now let's shift gears here a little bit and bring this conversation back here to the United States, where this country started out, as I guess most countries did historically anyway, as an agrarian society.
Exactly.
It was made up of many, many, many small farms. In fact, that was kind of the way people were able to feed themselves. There wasn't anything along the lines of, you know, the modern food store back in the 1700s.
Right. Exactly.
And you have an entire chapter in the book that is called "A Republic Cannot Have Large Farms." Now,
exactly.
You are Greek.
This is the tradition I bring in my writing.
Mm-hmm.
Greek history, it teaches a lot of things, but one of the key lessons is that of democracy. You cannot have democracy if you have giant farms. That was true in Athens, as it's true right now in Iowa. The Athenians, indeed, had a law that you could not, the largest farmer could not have an amount of land that was five times larger than the smaller. So they knew that equity and justice is part of the way of doing anything. And agriculture in ancient times was more than just raising food. It was part of reinventing religion, traditions, festivals, and political relations. All the farmers would become the soldiers to defend their land. So this is the tradition that passed through the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire, and it came down to Thomas Jefferson. So when Thomas Jefferson spoke about the yeoman, he spoke about the Greek yeoman. That was the image in his head. And he was right. You could not have a political democracy if you don't have an economic democracy. In other words, you cannot have a person with 10,000 acres of land right next to a person who has only 50 acres of land. That is completely inconceivable. You have jealousies, you have conflict, you have domination, and you have the kind of feudal economy that the Dark Ages was well known for it. Feudalism was an absolute tyranny of the few over the many. This is what I think this modern version of agribusiness is trying to reinvent, right, to bring back. And I regret to say that in the United States we are moving systematically in that direction. We are trying to recreate what the Soviet Union used to have, the state farms, so that agribusiness, to me, in my mind, they are becoming nothing else but state farms, funded, subsidized by the state. We spent $20 billion subsidizing those monsters right here in this country, right now. And you talk about research, for instance. There's only $17 million that go to alternative farm research in this country, that is for organic farming and people that have a small amount of land. And there's $1.5 billion going to agribusiness research. And as I said, 65 land-grant universities, most of their scientists, thousands of them, do nothing but work for the projects that will bring more money to agribusiness, whether it's genetic engineering, whether it's more fancy tractors, more way of exploiting the land, and, of course, the development of pesticides and chemicals.
Well, and that is
wrong.
And a lot of this is geared toward minimizing the cost to the consumer in a monetary sense at the store and for export.
And for export. And, of course, in what we are saying is that they don't take into consideration the damage they do to the land, that is to nature. That cause, the economists call externality, which is wrong, and it's unethical. If you kill 1 million fish by spraying herbicide, and then you have a rain, and all this chemical goes into the river, and you kill 1 million fish, would do that they call externality. Nobody pays for it, and the government allows it, and the government knows about it. When in the Pacific Northwest, for instance, or in the rest of the country, they use a herbicide in the parts per trillion. Now, a part per trillion is so tiny you cannot see it almost. It's like you have a human hair and you compare it with the length of the entire country of the United States. It's minute, so that they spray this chemical, this herbicide, in the grams per acre. Think of what I mean, what I'm saying, grams per acre. Tiny amounts, and yet that stuff is so powerful that it can kill a tree. So that, to me, is biological warfare. It's not longer any kind of pesticide, whatever you want to call it. It's biological warfare, chemical warfare in the farm. That's what I meant when I said that they transfer warfare technology into agriculture. And that, to me, is completely unethical, and it's against any version of civilization. And I presume that this country wants to continue to call itself part of the Western tradition. Well, it would not fit the Greek model, I can tell you that. We need to get back into the Greek ideas of democracy, and so that supporting only very few people to control all this empire of land, it's undemocratic. And this country goes all over the world say, hey, we're going to spread democracy. They're fighting a war in Iraq supposedly to bring democracy, and they're destroying democracy at home.
Yeah,
that is what I mean.
That's actually what I talked about all last week on the program, how the invasion of Iraq has completely redesigned that entire society through the Coalitional Provisional Authority orders. But that was a different program. And I want to let people know that they're listening to Evagelos Valianatos. He is the author of This Land is Their Land, How Corporate Farms Threaten the World. And we've been taking a meandering tour through the book, which touches on many, many topics, such as family farms versus agribusiness, the intentional poisoning of the food supply. He looks at genetic engineering, issues related to land ownership. And when we left off, we were talking about a little bit about the chapter, A Republic Cannot Have Large Farms. And I want to kind of segue from that concept, because large farms have not so much been systems which support life, although things do grow. They have really more modeled, as you refer to on page 159 in the chapter about a republic not having large farms, most things in agriculture are death systems.
Exactly.
And the reason that, well, the reason, I don't know if I can actually explain the reason, but the practice is such that, as you referenced earlier, the massive quantities of chemicals that are poured onto land 77,000, I believe, is the last number of chemicals that the EPA regulates. I guess not all of them are agricultural, but we don't know a lot of the potential long-term effects of using these chemicals because studies have never been done on a lot of them. How do you think that we can turn this around? You referenced the need for land reform here in the United States, which I think is a great idea. It doesn't seem to make sense for anyone to have control over more land than they can actually work.
Exactly.
So how do we get to there? Because land ownership is in increasingly fewer and fewer hands, and the government certainly doesn't seem to have any interest in this idea. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on how do we push for agrarian land reform in the United States?
Okay. Now, before I answer this question, let me just briefly account to something that happened almost 50 years ago that is actually at the heart of this problem. In 1941, the U.S. Department of Agriculture asked an anthropologist working for the organization in California named Walter Goldsmith to study two communities, one surrounded by small farms and the other surrounded by agribusiness, large farms. He discovered that the one that was surrounded by small farms, named Dinuba, was doing very well. They had schools, churches, the sort of things you expect in a kind of a small community. The other one, Arvin, that was surrounded by farms of 500 acres and more, they had a school was falling apart. They had no lights, no sidewalks. They had no money. The school had no money. And the people who lived in the community were more or less transient. So he, to make the long story short, he wrote a book about it, and he was ready to give it to his superiors where they wanted to suppress it. But he gave it to a senator, and that's how we have the study. In other words, he demonstrated what the Greeks knew 2,000 years before, that you cannot have democracy if you have too much power in few hands. And this is the net effect of all these changes that are taking place. Now, how we are going to get agrarian reform in the United States is we're going to do it by electing people that are actually, that their heart is with democracy and justice. There's too much power in very few hands. I mean, for instance, there were thousands and thousands of farmers in the United States that would do their own slaughtering of pigs, of cattle, or whatever. Now, you have four to five companies slaughtering over 50% of cattle or anything else. So you have too much, the concentration of power in the United States right now in agriculture is so massive that the only way I can understand it is I can refer always to the Dark Ages where you have a feudal landlord controlling half of France, for instance, or one other, a whole island all by himself. So we are going to change that by electing people in Congress and in our local governments who are Democrats. Their heart is in democracy and they care about social justice. So we have to give a chance to people who want to be farmers, to be farmers. Right now, the real hope is with the small number of people who are growing at 25% per year, that is the organic farmers. And they have found a niche within agriculture. They produce things without the chemicals, and they're doing the things that their grandfathers used to do. Now they call that organic. That's fine with me. The question is that they're doing something right. Their methods of agriculture are correct. They don't destroy the land, and they have, in general, small amounts of land. Though in California, I'm afraid that even those organic farmers are going out of their way to imitate the conventional farmers on whose shadow they actually work. You see farmers, one next to each other, one conventional and the other non-conventional, organic. And you wonder what happens when the spray takes place. Mm-hmm. The wind moves the spray all over the land. And therefore, they may contaminate even the places where it should not be contaminated so they can sell those crops certified organic.
Well, and another issue is a lot of organic produce, the larger brands that people see in stores, those are grown on very large farms. These are not 40-acre family-scale farms. Now, some of the brands, in fact, are a cooperative brand which is made up of many suppliers at a smaller scale. Mm-hmm. But that's more the exception, is my understanding. So there's this whole issue of – It's partly that, but it's also an issue of the scale of the farm. And, you know, who do you have doing the work? Is it a machine or is it people?
Exactly, yeah. And because of the massive size of the farmers, by the way, we have this problem that the whole country is arrived at right now, that is the farmer of migration. Most of the people who migrate to North America, that is from Mexico and Central America, they come to pick up the crops. They become the slaves we rent. And they become a subsidy to giant agriculture. And they are to be found all over the country. I mean, any place you have a factory farm of hogs, for instance, it's all the people that work there and the people who do slaughter, they are fundamentally foreigners because they come and they work in a very dangerous environment and they get a minimum wage or even only less than minimum wage. So we are making it easy for these people to continue this kind of slave economy and terrible conditions for these migrant people, that they should have at least some more respect. We can do away with all this by paying the people that do all these hard works a decent, a living wage. And we can begin to break up these massive factories. That's what my recommendation is. If we elect a good government, the good government with our support, we have to break up this massive trust of giant agribusinesses that control most of our food. This is terrible, not only for political reasons, but for economic and ecological reasons, as we explained. It's just not appropriate for a democratic society to give so much power to so few hands, so few corporations. The corporations were not elected. They gradually used the influence of the government to become what they are today. So it's just common sense. I mean, I don't need to have a PhD to understand these things. You don't do that. I mean, if you have too much power, you're going to have the consequences. We know that power corrupts, and of course, giant power corrupts absolutely, whether it's in a state or in a community.
Now, we've got just a few minutes here left, and I just want to introduce one last concept that relates to something we've already discussed. We talked about the deleterious effects of industrial agriculture to the land. We talked about the negative impacts to society in sort of the broad abstract. And I want to close out the program by just noting in one of your later chapters, you have a section called Industrialism is Giving Cancer to the World. And
yes,
the most direct way in which people can see or experience the impacts, if they're not working in the farms themselves, the impacts of industrial agriculture is their own personal health.
Exactly.
If you are not eating organic food, and I know that everybody can't, and you can't, even people who do, you can't always.
Right.
We're all taking in a small amount of poison with every meal.
Exactly.
You do this over a lifetime, and it's not all that surprising that the incidence of cancer in cultures where industrial agriculture has taken hold since the late 40s has skyrocketed. It's not a surprise. What would you recommend to folks? What would you recommend for listeners to do to make an impact here in supporting smaller scale local farms?
Well, my first suggestion would be to find farmers who raise food without poisons and make a commitment, a personal commitment. And there's a lot of farmers like that, and the whole movement is known as community-supported agriculture. And you pay $500, $600 per year, and you get a fresh basket of fruits and vegetables in season. That way you help this person, man or woman, to keep doing the good work that they do. And at the same time, you benefit personally, your health, and you know you're supporting also your community. The other thing they can do is to try to talk to people in their cities to commit a certain amount of money to buy organic food for the school children, for the cafeteria of the schools, and maybe even have a small garden so that the children begin to have a practical idea what it is that we mean when we say that we grow organic food. So between that practice and eating organic food, we immediately improve the health of thousands of children, and of course us, if we eat organic food, we certainly have a better chance not to get cancer and not to get all sorts of other neurological diseases that come about by eating contaminated food.
And I guess you could also recommend farmers markets, which, you know, although,
yes, of course, yes.
Although they're not organic, there are organic growers there, but we had a conversation on our airwaves earlier today with Michael Pollan, who has written extensively about all things plant and agriculture.
Yes, yes.
And there's this interesting debate that we're obviously not going to have time to get into because we're just about out of time, but there's this issue of, is organic better than local if it comes from far away? Which is
if it comes from far away, yeah. I would agree that the local part would be much better than getting, say, organic vegetables out of Mexico. Yes, I agree.
Yeah,
no doubt in my mind.
That's what I hear a lot more people saying. Well, I'm sorry we only had an hour to talk about your book. It's full of fascinating stories, many of which we didn't even touch upon because we were more kind of looking to, the more broadly applicable content as opposed to your own personal experience in visiting different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with Evagelos Valianatos. He is the author of This Land Is Their Land, How Corporate Farms Threaten the World, put out by Common Courage Press.